Good morning, everyone. I'm Scott Park, and I'm with Duke Energy Indiana. And so for my section today, I'm going to give a brief overview of the different types of resources that a utility would use to meet a customer's load. And so continuing on with what Matt talked about, he talked about all the work that goes into forecasting what customers want in terms of electricity. I'm going to take the other side of that issue and talk about, well, what resources must a utility bring to serve the needs of electrical customers. And so, given the variety of resources, I think it's somewhat useful to group them into a number of different categories and keep them straight. We'll kind of keep going back to them and drilling into these a little bit more deeply. And so in terms of resource categories, we've got this first bucket we're calling dispatchable supply side. Essentially, that's your typical utility generator, and that might be a nuclear facility, a coal facility, a gas facility. We've also got some variable supply side, and what we mean by that is they're not dispatchable. We don't control them. They run primarily through a function of, you know, what's the cloud cover, the solar intensity of the given location, how hard the wind is blowing, what type of water flow you might see through a river. Next, on the demand side, you know, that would be something like energy efficiency or combined heat and power, a source or a resource that is much closer to where the energy is ultimately consumed. And then the last category is distributed generation, and that can really be almost any of these technologies that I talked about previously, but again, they tend to be further out into the transmission or distribution field and closer to where those resources are consumed. And as we get further into my section, we'll go into all of these in more detail. So again, building on what Matt talked about, this is a daily load profile, and that's what we see here in the with the black line, where it kind of bottoms out in the morning and then peaks late in the afternoon. Matt talked about how we get to the black line. Now I'm going to take, well, how do we serve the black line? And so with that, you know, I'll first direct your attention to this yellow wedge here, and that is the energy provided by solar resources. And not surprisingly, you know, once the sun comes up, gets a little bit up in the sky, those facilities start to produce. It peaks early afternoon, starts tapering off in the evening. The thing I would like to mention here is that is, you know, somewhat volatile. You know, it can be, say we have a hot, muggy day that's like 90 degrees, it's very hot. Just the humidity in the air and the cloud cover might prevent solar facilities from producing much energy. On the other hand, it might be a cool summer or a cool winter day, beautiful blue skies, summer facilities just pumping it out. It's just very dependent upon location as well as the locational weather that solar facility is experiencing. Next, this purple band increases. And wind obviously isn't necessarily directly subject to solar, to sunshine, I should say, but the wind typically blows most of the time, but not always. And what we've seen are that wind generation tends to peak a little bit more at night than it does in the daytime. Not necessarily good or bad, it's just different and something that the utility system and transmission system needs to be able to incorporate, adjust to, as we serve customers' needs. Moving down the stack, we got this green wedge. Those are peaking resources. They tend to be something like combustion turbines that you'll typically hear about. We'll get into that in more detail. The light blue area are intermediate resources. They kind of pick up the bulk of those kind of waking hour load. And, you know, and then contrasting that with this bottom piece, the tan, those are the baseload resources. Typically what you want in a baseload resource is a facility that's very cheap to operate and can run for days, weeks on end to provide customers with the lowest cost energy as we go forward. So now what I'd like to do is just go over the different types of resources and just give a quick snippet on what each of those resources means, and then we'll go into some of the details, talk about the economics of each of these resources, and hopefully come around at the end of this section with basic fundamental understanding what each of these resources are, as well as when they're appropriately used. So starting with that is nuclear. I think everybody's seen pictures of nuclear or driven down the interstate and seen nuclear plants. plans where the, you know, you'll see the hyperbolic cooling towers, but that's not always the case. Sometimes you'll see nuclear facilities near large bodies of water, and they won't have the cooling towers. But essentially, these units take uranium as their fuel source, use the heat to boil water, that makes steam, turns a turbine, makes electricity. Next up is a coal unit, which they're somewhat similar, but obviously they're not, but the principle is still the same. Burning coal, boiling water, making steam to make electricity. Now next up, we've got these combined cycles and combustion turbines. And I'd like to talk about the combustion turbine first, since that's easier. And essentially, just think about the engine on the airplane next time you're at the airport. Essentially, you put fuel in, it turns the turbine, that turns the shaft, turns the generator, makes electricity. But also what you probably noticed when you've been at the airport, if you look out the back of an engine that's running, there's an awful lot of heat coming off the back end that is just doing absolutely nothing. To capture all that waste heat, combined cycle technology has been developed. And essentially what that is imagine a jet engine. Well, rather than just letting that heat dissipate into the atmosphere, let's capture that heat, use that to boil water, which again, similar to the nuclear and the coal-fired facility, take that steam to turn a steam turbine, use that to make additional electricity, and in the process of doing so, a combined cycle gets more electricity out of a single unit of fuel. I think as we go forward with the clean power plan, and we're not necessarily going to get into that much today, combined cycles, given particularly the low gas prices we're seeing today, look like a very attractive option going forward. Next up is biomass. This is a very broad category of generation. But in terms of a dispatchable resource, it's primarily burning a replenishable fuel, and so it might be wood chips, switchgrass, that sort of thing. But then again, biomass can be something such as, you know, anaerobic digesters, which kind of takes advantage of some bacteria doing their work, and you know, also poking holes in landfills to capture the methane at the landfill, using that to burn a turbine, like a combustion turbine. Next up, reservoir hydro, and the reason I specify reservoir hydro is because there really are two types of hydro facilities. In a reservoir hydro facility, that's something where you see they've got the big dams, and they can store significant quantities of water, and then depending on, you know, water coming into the system, water needs going out of the reservoir, water can be spilled, that'll turn a turbine, generate electricity. So in doing so, depending on the water flow and levels, there is some ability to modulate how much electricity is provided. Talk about run of river in a moment, but that has some different operational characteristics. Next up are batteries, and again, you know, that's a emerging technology within the utility field. Conceptually, it's just like you would think of any other rechargeable battery that you might use in your laptop, on your phone, what have you. Batteries in and of themselves do not generate electricity. Essentially, you need to make electricity via some other method. Use that electricity to inject it into the battery, and then use that at some other time. Now the challenge there is, that's not necessarily a free turn. You'll put in, say, a kilowatt hour of energy into a battery, you're not necessarily gonna get all of that back. Over time, one would think that batteries will be able to hold more energy, as well as probably do so more efficiently. But that is something that's more of an emerging technology at this point, but something that we do look at. And the next is combined heat and power. Sometimes that's called cogen. And essentially what that is you might have an industrial facility, and for whatever process they do in that plant, many times they need steam. And so they might have their own boiler where they'll burn natural gas, make steam, and use that in their process. That isn't by itself terribly efficient. But what can be done, and it's very site-specific, and it does feature a number of site-specific challenges, you can generate steam, provide that to the plant for their process, but you can also size things so you're generating steam primarily through electricity production, and in doing so, create a more overall efficient resource for both the back facility as well as the power plant. And so you're bringing gas in, you're making electricity and steam, capturing more of the heat and using that for electricity as well as production. All right, so those are the dispatchable resources. Moving on to the variable supply side. Solar and wind, I think everybody pretty much knows what we're talking about there. The solar facilities, you know, we see them all at the airport is a really good example that people drive by all the time. And then wind farms, you know, primarily driving up, I guess it's 65. You can see them off into the distance. They're turning depending on how hard the wind's blowing. A utility doesn't control how much production a solar facility produces as well as how much of a wind farm produces. And as a result, that just becomes an added variable that either the utility or the RTO needs to handle as they operate the system. Run-of-river hydro, this is a little more common in the Midwest, and essentially, if you think about this, this is kind of the old water wheel on the side of the creek back in the old movies. Essentially, depending on how the water is moving down the stream, it'll turn some sort of turbine, and that'll be the means that electricity is generated. It's subject to water levels and a bunch of other factors that go into that, but it's kind of a you take it when you get it type resource, but again, can be a very attractive resource in that, you know, there's very little operating costs. Moving on to the demand side, you know, certainly there's energy efficiency. I've got a slide or two, you know, a few slides down the way that we'll talk about that. But one of the things that I would like to point out with energy efficiency, unlike, you know, say a coal plant where, depending on size, a coal plant is a coal plant is a coal plant, energy efficiency isn't one thing. It's really hundreds of things. And that can be something as, you know, such as lighting. It can be something in terms of an industrial motor, air conditioning, or it can be something like passive, like insulation in your house. Energy efficiency, I think, is important to me. It's important to remember it's not one thing, it's many things, and each one of those things has unique attributes. In terms of demand response, that can it can also be come in different forms, and it can be something where the utility makes a payment to a customer. And in exchange for that, the customer can respond in a couple of different ways. They can turn down their load. They can turn on their own customer-owned generation. And in doing so, that removal of load kind of looks like a generator, and that can be used to meet the total system need at a given point in time. And then lastly, distributed generation. Certainly, this is getting talked about more and more, and this can be, you know, many of the technologies we've talked about before, but as I've mentioned earlier, those can be, generally speaking, pushed further out in the field and tend to be smaller in size, closer to the customer's end use and consumption of electricity. So that was kind of a high-level description of what each of these resource types are. Now I'd like to move into some of the economics of each of these resources. Because there's trade-offs, and so if we're talking about a normal factory, because really a power plant is just that, it's a factory that makes electricity, and let's say I was a car maker. Well, I could have multiple car factories, and they would do their thing, and they would shut down at, say, 5 o'clock if I'm running one shift. The inventory would sit there overnight, and the next morning it'd start up and do it again, not to mention all the storage that would happen at wholesale level and out at the car lot. Electricity isn't like that. We need to have a multitude of different types of factories because electricity production needs to meet demand every single hour. And so to do that, we need several different types of factories, and each one of those have different economic trade-offs. And so that's what I'd like to touch on here. I don't want to necessarily get too much into the specific dollar amounts, but it does show some interesting relative differences that I'll speak to. So first of all, nuclear. That's a big, tall bar. And You know, that's just one of the realities of nuclear. They're very expensive to build. In addition to that, they take a long time to build. The flip side of that, once you do have them online, they run relatively inexpensively, generate almost full output most of the time, not to mention that it's carbon-free generation. So with that high price tag, there are some benefits, but you know, as of right now, particularly with low gas prices, nuclear is a little bit of a tougher sell right now. Next up, and this is, you know, loaded with acronyms, advanced CC with CCS. That's a combined cycle, and again, that's the essentially the jet engine with the steam turbine on the back end. But with the added machinery of capturing part of the CO2 out of the exhaust and essentially burying that underground. Now, you know, that's a whole other effort, and that's no small task on its own. But as you'll see here, compared to the, you know, just the regular generator combined cycle, you know, the costs are on the order of double because of that. In addition to CCS, it tends to be very site-specific in that you need to have the geology close by that can handle the injection of CO2 into the ground. Now, there are some industrial applications that use CO2. That's more of a oil recovery thing, and you'll see some of that in the Gulf Coast area. But as of right now, combined or carbon capture and sequestration is relatively expensive, and there seems to be certainly more economic ways to reduce carbon than necessarily capturing it and burying it. I talked about combined cycle. They're becoming increasingly efficient, not to mention with lower gas prices. They provide an awful lot of energy and are, again, flexible. They're dispatchable. You can ramp them up during the daytime. You can ramp them down in the evening if you need to. But, a combined cycle, particularly the new efficient ones, I think do have a significant role in the future of the energy system. CTs, again, that's the jet engine. They're cheaper, but they're not that efficient. So you don't want to run them much. You only want to run them when you need them. And so typically, you'll run those more in the afternoon when you're kind of peaking and needing the most electricity at that given point in time. And then lastly, biomass. That tends to be relatively expensive. Again, it's similar to, say, a coal plant. And I guess some of you might cringe that biomass is just a different, it's newer coal. But essentially, you're burning something, you know, and using that to make electricity. The challenge with biomass frequently is that it's just, the fuel is less dense from an energy perspective, and so the volume of fuel that you need to move is much greater. And so you might have to truck in, you know, dozens and dozens of trucks of wood chips, for instance, or garbage for that matter, in a given period of time, and that creates its own challenges. The other technologies, whether it's anaerobic digesters or landfill gas, they might have selected roles, but they tend to produce not that much energy and they're very site-specific. So that's kind of a high-level trade-off of the economics of these different types of technologies. If we move to the variable supply side, we got the photovoltaic, and that's essentially solar facilities. And solar, while it's fairly straightforward in terms of the panels that capture the energy of the sun and convert that electricity, frequently you'll see the cost of a solar facility vary greatly. If we're talking about rooftop solar in terms of dollars per kW, which is how we're measuring things, it's very expensive because not only do you have the panels, you have all the infrastructure that supports that, and without any economies to scale, you don't have a lot of kWs to spread those costs over. So rooftop solar for a single home can be quite expensive. At the other end of the spectrum, you know, a large solar facility like we see out at the airport has a lot more kWs to spread those costs over, and as a result, you do see those economies of scale that benefit larger projects. And then lastly, I'd just point out that, you know, when a solar panel generates electricity, it makes it in DC current, whereas our system runs on AC. So there needs to be a conversion process to go from DC to AC power. As a result, you know, we're changing the amount of energy, and we can change the units. And so sometimes you'll have to, you know, clarify, is the solar facility, is that dollar per kWh in DC terms or AC terms? And then lastly, you know, just like any other generator, it needs to be hooked up to the grid, and that can be a variable that sometimes isn't included in the solar price. And so interconnection costs are certainly a very relevant factor there for solar. Onshore wind, you know, that's technology's been around for a long, long time. I think one of the more exciting things that we're seeing here with wind is that, and some of you might have seen from some of the utility stakeholder presentations, a map of the state, the U.S., and they'll kind of show how good different parts of the state or the country are in terms of wind. Well, there's a different map for different altitudes. Mm-hmm. And, you know, typically we've been kind of more in the 80-meter level recently, but now we're starting to see some projects that are at the 100-meter level. And actually, it's quite interesting to see how much different the wind profile changes between 80 meters and 100 meters. And so, you know, personally, I think that is what I think one of the things that we could see, you know, a big benefit on the wind side from is having essentially these taller towers. Now, think about that. 80 meters is 260 feet up in the air. You know, when you go to 100 meters, you know, maybe you're at 330 feet. So they're getting very, very large, which might create some other issues, but that seems to be one of the more interesting changes that we're seeing with regard to onshore wind. And then with regard to hydro, you know, hydro is obviously a very nice resource. It's clean. You might lose some areas of the country that you necessarily wouldn't want to submerge in water, and typically you see some of those conversations taking place in the West where they got these very large reservoirs. But a lot of the good sites have already been taken advantage of with regard to the hydro facilities. And, you know, when appropriate, I think it makes sense certainly to take advantage of hydro. It tends to be very expensive, but again, can be very cheap. But I think it's also worth talking about where there's existing hydro facilities, to the extent that those sites can be maintained and preserved, there's a lot of value there. But you know, given where we are in the Midwest, hydro is, generally speaking, a smaller part of the resource mix. Okay, so those were primarily what we were seeing on the supply side. Now I'd like to move over onto the demand side, because things get a little more complicated and a little less standardized. So starting with that, you know, energy efficiency, and as I've mentioned, it's not one thing, it's many things. And here's two examples. And they really could be more different. You got a light bulb over here on the bottom, but then you've got insulation. Now, it might seem kind of crazy at first to start equating those in terms of some sort of electricity resource, but, you know, the fact of the matter is they do enter into the equation. Obviously, lighting is a huge demand for electricity. To the extent those lights can be more efficient, that can lessen the need for generation, and in doing so, look like a resource. Same thing can be said for insulation. You know, if you've purchased a number of homes over your life, you know, you might have bought a newer home. It's just warm everywhere. On the other hand, you might have bought an older home, and you've got hot spots, and you've got cool spots. Those changes affect the heating or cooling need of that home, and as a result, use more energy, whether it's natural gas, propane, heating oil, or electricity. But having said that, insulation can look like a generator in some form, or displace a generator. But that's an important thing to realize, is that energy efficiency is a very wide, varied source of for electricity, and doesn't necessarily lend itself to one size fits all. Now, I'm not going to go into the individual measures other than to cite examples such as the bulbs or the insulation, but I did want to talk about energy efficiency is typically categorized at maybe three, maybe four different levels. And so there's a technical potential, and essentially that is like theoretically how much energy could you save if you did everything you could. And so, say for this room, we might be able to change every light bulb. And let's say it's like this brand new light bulb nobody's ever heard of, and it hardly uses any power at all, but it's very, very expensive. And there might be some things we can do with the HVAC, some insulation. Again, very, very expensive, for example purposes, but you could save, you know, this much energy. Well, that might not make any sense because it's cost prohibitive to undertake those activities. And so if we start factoring what is the cost, what makes sense from a dollars and cents standpoint, then you're down into the economic potential. And so whereas before theoretically we could get this much savings, once we factor in what makes sense from a dollars and cents standpoint, maybe you're only saving this much. Well, having said that, you know, what we've typically experienced is that even though something makes sense from an economic standpoint, customers don't necessarily always adopt these energy efficiency measures. So that's where this achievable potential comes in. And essentially that reflects the actual adoption levels of energy efficiency programs. So you might have X energy savings making cost-effective sense. You're going to have some fraction of that being the achievable potential. And I think that's useful to talk about things in terms of these three levels, primarily achievable level, because that's really an expectation when it comes to long-term planning that we have in the resource plan. This last point was touched on a little bit earlier. I'd say generally speaking, in the past, energy efficiency and demand response and distributed generation were handled more on the load forecast side. There's been efforts, and I think all the utilities have done that, using different methods to kind of take some of these resources out of the load forecast, package them into a something analogous to a supply side resource and model that. Now, having said that, I haven't seen a clear winner of this is the best way to do it. I've seen several reasonable ways to do it, but that's one of those things that's really up to each individual utility to decide. And, you know, I think certainly as part of that individual stakeholder meeting, but taking these sort of resources, putting them out of the load forecast onto the resource side, is a significant challenge and certainly something that we've talked about for many, many times in the future. I wanted to put these up here to provide a little more context about how energy efficiency kind of factors in to the overall mix. And so on the left, you know, again, we kind of got the black line, that's your baseline forecast. What energy efficiency does is effectively reduces the amount of demand that the electricity needs to serve over time. So, you know, if say there was no energy efficiency, and we stated the black line, and that black line still would include energy efficiency, primarily via codes and standards, but there is still energy efficiency in that baseline forecast. But to the extent the utility has programs that incent additional energy efficiency, you can see that these different colored lines get progressively lower as the amount of energy efficiency increases. And so you might take a situation where you've got positive load growth, but given enough energy efficiency, that could, you know, negate that low growth, but it also reduce, result in lower or negative load growth. And then over here on the right, this is just another depiction of what I talked about with the running from the technical potential to the achievable potential, but there's this third dimension that shows how that's over time. And so like I talked about, not only is the technical potential the highest, but, you know, there's also the most growth going forward, and that's by this back left bar that's the tallest. You know, in terms of expectation, that's where we're on the achievable potential, which is the series of bars on the right. Not only do we start out at a lower point, there's less growth in it. So over time, you end up having, you know, much lower energy efficiency over time as opposed to the technical potential. Now I'd like to move on to demand response. And as I mentioned, that's essentially the utility paying a customer to either curtail load or turn on generation, and as a result, reducing the need, and in doing so, acting like a generator. And this can come in a bunch of different forms. I touched on those. This last bullet, this Volt VAR program, that's becoming increasingly common among utilities. And this kind of talks about the increasing role that the transmission and distribution grid is taking in a future world of the utility. And so essentially, and without getting into too much technical detail, the electricity, primarily at the distribution level, that's usable by people's homes, is at a certain voltage. And over the distance of a distribution line, that voltage decreases. Well, there can be some technology added to the distribution system that essentially flattens that out, plus also gives the grid operator the ability to modulate the level of that voltage. And in doing so, that can actually look like a resource. So in terms of peak times, there might be the opportunity to reduce voltage and as a result, reduce the demand on the system at that point in time. And, you know, that's an example of a transmission resource or a distribution resource, I should say, looking like a generation resource. And really speaks to more of the evolving nature of the electricity system, whereas before it was kind of like a series of pipes. The generator made it, pushed it down the big pipe of the transmission system. Those got pushed into the small pipes of the distribution system, ultimately to end use. Some of the benefits of demand response is that you know, certainly there's more control that customers can use over their energy consumption and billing. It allows us to reduce peaks, and in doing so, we might be able to defer additional generation. In terms of challenges, and this is somewhat interesting, is that, you know, people, being people, you know, say, yeah, I will take that $5, $10, whatever utility company will give me in exchange for being able to turn off my air conditioner, pool pump, what have you, so many times. Well, it's okay as long as they don't do that. But as soon as the utility starts, you know, activating some of these demand response programs, people start questioning, well, do I want to participate with that anymore? And in doing so, they might drop out of the program. So that's kind of a challenge that you like to use demand response programs, but be careful you don't use them too much because they might go away. And then the other thing I wanted to mention is that, you know, a utility will have a given amount of demand response. And let's say they want to have more demand response. Well, to do that, your previous incentives weren't sufficient to get more. So you're going to have to raise your incentives to get more people to participate. Well, not only do you need to do that, but you also need to provide that incentive change to the previous participants. As a result, that incremental cost for this incremental piece of demand response gets relatively costly rather quickly. So, lastly, I want to touch on distributed generation. And like I said, it can come in a variety of forms, and you know, I've listed those here. One thing I would like to talk a little bit more about are, you know, combined heat and power, as well as energy storage. And in combined heat and power, again, that's where this primarily a manufacturing facility, but it can also be a, you know, universities are potential good candidates for combined heat and power. They use a lot of steam for heating their campuses. They're somewhat limited by application. You need to find a good customer or host is the term for the steam sales. And then you hook that up to the grid so the electricity system can absorb any fluctuations in electricity generated by this facility. And this is something that, it's kind of an efficiency play. You're capturing more benefits, primarily electricity and steam, per unit of fuel. G
challenge is it's relatively site-specific in terms of its application. And then, as I mentioned, with energy storage, it's still very expensive, but you know, it does do a couple nice things. You might be able to generate a lot of power at a certain time when it's very inexpensive to do so. Well, since storage, you know, before recent times, really couldn't be stored in mass quantities, and maybe it can't be right now. If you could do that and just hang on to it and then use it when you really need it, there's potentially a lot of benefits there. Right now, battery technology is evolving. It's getting better. It's getting cheaper. But, you know, right now it tends to be very expensive and it's very big. You know, if you looked at, a common gas plant, for instance, I generate 1,000 megawatts in a given hour. If we filled up this whole room with batteries, that might be worth 2 megawatts. And so kind of the size issue is somewhat of a challenge as well. And, you know, right now it seems like batteries tend to have more benefits, not so much from a electricity generation standpoint, rather site-specific transmission and distribution support resources. But again, that's another one of those aspects. It's evolving over time, and while storage might have a particular role right now, that role in the future could end up being very different. And then lastly, I guess on the benefit side, certainly by having things closer to where the energy is consumed, there's some avoided line losses. You know, some of the challenges that we're dealing with, and I touched on this earlier, is that since the utility of the RTO doesn't control production out of, say, solar and wind, for instance, the rest of the generating system needs to move up and down and be more nimble to accommodate that. And again, that's kind of more that evolving system is moving from a pure generate and distribute. Now the generation needs to make swings that it didn't have to previously to accommodate the intermittency of these types of resources. But again, it's not as simple as that. The transmission system can also do things that help out the generation side of things. So I guess with that, we've got 5 minutes for questions.
Sounds perfect. Again, if you've got a question, please write.